evening and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey, and on the Icecast we talk to comic artists, writers and publishers about their work, their lives and everything in between. And tonight on the Icecast I'm very happy to welcome the amazing and multi-talented Jessica Martin. Good evening, Jessica.
Good evening, Shane, and good evening everybody out there in comics land who will be watching this. I'm sure there'll be loads of you.
Well,
oh,
yes.
Oh, by the way, it's not Christmas yet. I'm just a bit previous. So.
That's okay. We're only doing audio, so they can't see that you've actually got a Christmas tree behind you.
Oh, great. Oh, so I don't have to worry about eyelines or anything.
No,
oh,
you're all right. It doesn't matter about what you're wearing or what your hair's like or anything like that. Well, I do record the video, but I don't show anybody the video.
All right. Okay, for your private screening only at Shane Towers.
Maybe one day for posterity, you know, when it's an historical artifact, it'll be brought out. But by then, we'll be all long gone.
Yay, I'm counting on it. No, we'll be holograms. I'll be there.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. It'd be nice if I could be a hologram. I'd quite like that, I think. So I'd like to ask from the start, you got into comics in a very different way to most of the other people that I talk to on this podcast, because most of the other people I talk to on this podcast are fans, you know, from when they were children, and they sort of always wanted to do comics. It was sort of part of their DNA in a way. But you came into comics in a slightly unconventional way, didn't you?
Yes, and I came into comics at a much more, shall we say, mature stage of life. Although I have to say, Shane, that I'll be transparent about it. So the comics that I grew up with were, when I was very little, it would have been Rupert the Bear, which was everybody's favourite.
Oh, yeah.
And then for girls, we used to have loads of fantastic comics. So starting at the age of five, there was a little comic called Twinkle, Princess Tina. And I loved Diana was a really cool comic, and that used to have an annual. So I got a couple of those, I remember, over Christmas.
Oh, I don't think I know that one.
Diana. Oh, Diana's amazing. It used to have great spooky stories in it.
All right.
I just remember there was one called, it was The Night of the Witches, and this girl went to stay with her old aunt, and she was having to sit there listening to the old aunt with her friends, you know, exchanging stories back in my day. And the girl, I remember the thought bubble, she was saying, oh, I can't bear hanging around with these old fuddy-duddies. And one of the old crones says, old fuddy-duddies, we'll show you. And then there was this horrible thing where they all turned into these witches, and they had like a doll of, I mean, it was traumatizing. This is a comic for 8-year-old girls. But,
well, they were, anyway. Weren't they, the girls' comics? They were quite scary. I remember, I liked girls' comics. My sister used to get them, and stuff like Misty and things like that. And, yeah. And Girl, I remember Girl magazine, which had like photo comics in it. And I used to love all those. But Misty had some scary stories in it. And I remember thinking, oh, is this all right for my sister? Because I think I was probably about, you know, 8. And my sister was probably about 6. It's full of these horror stories. You know?
Well, I think girls like, as opposed to the boys, like everything very sort of graphic and, you know, smashing up things and gory scenes. We love a spooky story. So that was me growing up. And you mentioned girl comic. Mm. So I remember an aunt of mine, her daughter had gone off to boarding school. She was a few years older than me. And she had a collection of her daughter's old annuals. So there were copies of like Girl and I think, it was like something like Judy or Friend.
Yes. There was a Judy comic, if I remember correctly. It's going back a bit. I'm only using my memory. I've got...
Yes.
But yeah, I think there was a Judy.
Yeah, that went back. So those went back to the 50s, and they had really fantastic illustrations in them. So so I didn't want to draw comics. But you know what, Shane? You know, all of us have been revisiting our past a bit during the lockdown and,
indeed,
you know, decluttering and doing index cards for our collections, etc. So... let me just mention to the ladies and gents who may not know this, but I am first and foremost, I'm an actress and I was an impressionist. I was on lots of kind of 80s variety shows, Spitting Image, Copycats, etc. So we're in the process of moving house. So aside from lockdown, I had the big task of going into the loft, extracting boxes of stuff that literally have not been opened in 80 years.
A little treasure trove, I'm sure.
Treasure trove. And the reason why they haven't been unearthed is because we have two children who are now grown up, and really mummy's old life had nothing, wasn't relevant to bringing them up, and they're not interested in it. So mummy got these boxes out, and in one of the boxes were a collection of my darling late mum used to save everything, you know, school reports, dance certificates. You met her, Shane, didn't you, at one of the conventions, do you remember, with
Bob? I did, yeah, one of the early conventions, yeah.
Yes. So it was quite an emotional thing. I found this box that mum had saved, and she kept my artwork from when I was literally like 2 years old.
Oh, that's so sweet.
16, yeah. Oh. But I have to tell you, some of these, I mean, from the age of 6, I was obsessed with old movies.
Mm.
And this links to my theme in comics. Which
indeed.
We'll get to that down the line. So even at the age of 6, I'd been watching like MGM movies on the telly, and I was making up my own movie stars. I even had a poster with a vampire giving a lovely lady in the 30s dress a kiss on the neck, and it was called I Was Dracula's Lover. That was Jessica Martin's studio's film production. And essentially, I made comics. I made little stories with speech bubbles. But I never thought that that's what I was doing. But obviously, I felt that I wanted to express myself. I got very excited when I saw something on the television that just captured my imagination. I wanted to recreate it on the page.
And that's a great way of doing it, isn't it? With you can draw and you can write and you can combine that. And I think a lot of kids create comics without realizing that they're creating comics, just that desire to tell stories of their own.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, there is a wealth of very dark child psychology when you see what kids write. You know, I don't know whether you used to have this, Shane, but at school, we used to have to do this thing of my news, you know, so what you did during the week. And my one, I remember, I think my mum was mortified, but I wrote something about, oh, we stayed and we watched TV. We had leftovers. That was like, oh my God, you're letting the side down. You don't tell people.
Embarrass the parents. Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have social services.
I must have done that to my mother many times. I also had the habit of telling her friends what she thought of them.
Oh God, yes.
That's another one I used to do. Whiz.
Yeah.
At the age of 5, you know. So I remember this one lady came to the door once, and my mum had been saying, you know, which she shouldn't have been, you know, in front of me, age 5, probably thought it was okay. Oh, yeah, she's annoying me. She's coming round too much. And this lady came to the door, and I answered the door, and I said, Mum says you can't come round anymore because you're annoying her. My mum was absolutely mortified.
Oh, that is hilarious. I know you learn very early on. It's drama, isn't it? You learn that the script isn't what's being said. It's what the subtext is.
Oh, yeah. There is no subtext when you're 5.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, we're being taught at school to be honest. And, you know, and I was brought up Catholic, so we had to have confession, for goodness sake, as a little child. So it was all collecting all the bad things you've done and trying to be good. So we were just being helpful to our parents, you know. You were being helpful to your mum, saving her the aggravation, this annoying friend. But you know what? I mean, that is so like, I will get back onto comics in a minute, by the way.
Right.
But I'm just thinking about how, you know, when a friend phones you up and they're sharing stuff and they're maybe talking about someone you know and they're just offloading. And then with me, I always try and solve people's problems. They say, well, that's a toxic friendship, isn't it? You've got to draw the line. And then then you see that they've been in communication with that person as if nothing's happened. You go, oh, well, thanks. You know, you dump all that on me and then you're okay. You've had your free therapy.
They just want to have a moan, don't they? They just want to offload it. Yeah, make feel better. They're never going to do anything about it. And if you dare suggest any
solution.
I don't want you to solve it. I just want you to listen.
That's it. Yeah. That's what the subtext is. That's what, I mean, you know, do you know what it takes a lifetime to learn the active listening thing. But talking about, you know, letting off steam, and also talking about getting things done, you know, because the other thing that I've often, shall we say, advised friends. So for instance, I have friends who always kind of are surprised that I'm productive. They said, God, how did you do this? You know, because I have two children. Okay, they're grown up now, but I've always kind of juggled things. And if I want to do something, I'll do it. So friends will say to me, oh, I want to do this. I want to write a book or do that. And I'll tell them exactly how you break it down. And then they look at me like, you bitch, I don't want you to tell me. I really don't want, I'm quite happy just dreaming about it. Don't tell bloody, ooh, she's so can do.
I know exactly what you mean. It's the weight of success. They don't actually want the weight of that success, because I think sometimes people are happier in the dream, aren't they?
Yeah.
Rather than reality. And when you actually say, well, actually, you can do this if you take these steps and if you're willing to make these sacrifices, it's like, yeah, I actually don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I find that quite common, actually.
I know. And it's always like, you know, it's just a difference. And that's a big difference between the people that I know in the comics world and the ones who are the, you know, the Walter Mitty, the Billy Liars, who sit there and they'll just blame everything. Blame. My parents always said I was crap at art. I'm just not even going to start, you know. But I mentioned earlier that I came to the making comics thing quite late. And actually it was born out of a frustration with my first career, which, as I've mentioned, I'm an actress. And I had a lot of success that, to be honest, it came very easily and probably quicker than I expected in my, you know, my 20s. Like, you know, I had a talent for doing impressions. And as it's so often the way, even in comics, I suppose, if you have a gimmick, you can actually kind of fast track your way to places that if you'd gone the prescribed route. So for me, I always dreamed that I'd go to drama school, get in a rep company, and so on and so forth. And it didn't happen for me. And
So you took a much more direct route into your acting career.
Yeah, because with the impressions, it just so happened when I was doing them, we were on a zeitgeist. It's like television wanted impressionists. They were about to do, well, in fact, they'd had a series of Spitting Image. So my skills, which have been a little bit kind of old-fashioned, that hadn't been an impressionist show really since the Mike Yarwood show.
Well, yeah, they were big in the early 80s, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And there was Faith Brown. She was the person I watched. And then Tracy Ullman came, but she's wonderful, but she didn't do impressions, she did characters. So I was sort of in the wake of her, and literally overnight, I was 22 years old and I was on like three major, you know, Saturday night telly programs. And then I got Doctor Who. I did a guest spot in Doctor Who playing a character called Mags, right in the midst of all of this other wonderful sort of gravy train that was happening. So my career was sort of on a really lovely trajectory, and I did musical theatre. And then in my sort of mid-30s, I settled down and I had a family. And I can't, you know, people often say to me, oh, did you step away? Did things quieten down because you chose to bring up a family? And I have to be honest, yes, I brought up my family, but I think that it's just the natural pattern of things that you cannot have an uninterrupted line of career. You know, something's got to give. And I guess having a family as well, and for a woman, that is a big deal. You are less marketable as an actress in your 30s. You're not going to be playing the young ingenue. You're going to be waiting around for the character stuff, and your career isn't going to wait around for you to arrange childcare. So, you know, a few things came and went, and I never, I mean, I felt disappointed, but I can't say I ever felt bitter, because I do believe, I always felt extremely lucky that I'd had the success I had. And in some ways I used to think, well, do you know what? If that's as good as it gets and you've had that, then just, you know, move on. Maybe fate's got something else marked out for you. So I remember, and it was a family outing, Father's Day 2010. it's a very, very important time for me, Shane, because this was my epiphany moment.
All right. So,
we went on a family outing to the Tate Gallery. And and I remember being a bit sort of, I have to say, obviously, as a lover of comics, I love narrative art. And I don't really, I'm not really a fan of conceptual, where it's more about the idea, you know.
You like the storytelling side of it.
Yeah, and I do like things to be representational, and it's kind of sneered at in the elite art circle.
Oh, there's definitely a snobbery against representational art, isn't there? Or commercial art, or, you know, sequential art. If it's there's definitely a snobbery there, and it's totally unnecessary.
Yeah. I mean, I fully confess, and again, it's probably quite hip now, but, you know, I loved Ladybird books. I thought the paintings and the illustrations were exquisite. So I wasn't impressed. I went to the Tate and it just kind of didn't float my boat.
Didn't do it for you.
No, but I did pick up a really lovely book in the bookshop, which was called The Creative License, Permission to Be the Artist You Always Wanted to Be. That was a little kind of, parenthesis. And by Danny Gregory. And this book has, because I still got it on my bookshelf, really lovely hand-drawn picture, all coloured and felt tips. The writing and text was all handwritten. Wow. And the guy who wrote it had been a massively successful advertising executive. And he just said that he had this moment, his epiphany, where he decided that he'd sold his soul. And what he really wanted to do was to make hand-bound books. And he wanted to draw. And he wanted to do, you know, this thing, urban sketching, that's very popular.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know where people go, they just sort of sit on a... You see these people like sitting on a bench and they're drawing a building, whatever.
It's usually something that you do... You're forced to do it in college and then never get a chance to do it after art college. I did a lot of it in art college, you know.
Oh, right. Okay, so, well, swinging back to... So in my sixth form... When we did A-levels, I mean, I did A-level art and I got an A.
Oh, well done.
Proudly both. And I did, so what I did was I did theatre design and observational drawing. And, you know, it was by then, I mean, my early art that Mummy saved wasn't very good. But, you know, I learned something by osmosis in the art classes.
Yeah.
But I never, ever dreamed or wanted to go to art college because my heart was set on performing. Mm. But it's interesting. So with performing... I didn't go to a stage school. I ended up doing a degree. So it was more like a theoretical approach to it. So, so I haven't had a vocational training. And it's the same thing with my art. You know, my art is largely self-taught. Okay, got the A-level, but we all know the art teachers at school never taught you anything.
I have to say, I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, no, they didn't. They just used to
put... I left, yeah.
Yeah. They would put sugar paper up with a clip on the drawing board, stick a plant in front of you, get on with it, you know.
I don't think I've heard the word sugar paper since 1984. But instantly, images. Oh, I remember lining my sketchbooks at school with sugar paper because it was you get it in all different colours, couldn't you?
Yes. But it was horrible to draw.
Oh, it was impossible.
Pastels and those horrible bloody poster paints. So you had to mix the draw. Oh,
terrible.
No. I mean, they were doing everything to discourage you from being an artist at school. That's my conclusion.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So, sorry, fast forward. So I've got this wonderful book, Creative License, and I just felt my heart beating. I was sort of having a rush because I knew I had all these... I'm a stationery hoarder. Oh, don't judge.
Don't worry, I'm the same.
Yep. The amount of money that Amazon have made out of me for molding books, you know.
Yeah. Staples was mine. I used to spend hours in Staples just walking around looking at stationery. I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yeah. So it's just, I've got a stationery, I had a stationery shop ready to go, you know, when this, mad urge to draw came upon me. And literally from that day that I got the book, every day I was like Mummy's possessed. I was sitting in the car on the school run with my little sketchbook out, drawing houses, drawing cars, drawing the people, and so it went. And then guess what? You know, as soon as I was suddenly in love with something other than show business, I got this really great gig. I got to play Lady of the Lake in a tour of Spamalot.
Wow, that's typical, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. It's like an abusive relationship. You sort of ditch the boyfriend and they come back with flowers.
What an interesting analogy.
Yeah, that's life. So I went on this tour. But what I really wanted to do was I thought, I'm going to tour, going to do the job, and I'm going to have these days free to go and sort of go to a National Trust house or a castle. I'm going to draw all these amazing things. And of course, actually, truth is, when you're working in a show, it is just, it's so exhausting, and things, you know, publicity things to do during the day. So it didn't really happen, but I was working with Phil Jupitus. He was playing King Arthur, you know, because he's that natural casting for the king, isn't he?
Very good casting.
And he absolutely loves comics, and he used to go out every week. He'd go to the local Forbidden Planet, sorry, free advertising there,
that's all right.
Or he'd go to the local, where, you know, if there was a comic shop, indie comic shop, he'd go there. And I mentioned casually that the only comic artist I'd ever heard of, and I had a book of his, was Brian Talbot. So Phil came back with, he had Luther Arkwright from the comic shop, and he sort of slung that in front of me. And he slung a copy of The Boys in front of one of the knights who was a comics fan, you know.
Right.
And then I was thinking to myself, well, God, if he likes comics, he likes drawing, so I'm going to show him this sketchbook of mine, because being an actress, we just need to get our round of applause. We just can't keep it to ourselves. We have to get approval. So, I know. It's like, you know how it is at the conventions, and you're sitting there at your stall, and you've got somebody who's like, oh, they're going to buy one of your comics. But it just so happens, I'm a bit of a sketch artist myself. Do you want to have a look at?
Oh, yeah. Always get that.
Bloody amazing things, you know. Yeah. Okay. DC reviews are next door. So anyway, I got my review from Phil Jupitus, and he just said to me, oh, blimey, these are really good, you know, they've got a lot of dynamism in it, sort of like those unfinished Disney sketches where they didn't have the, you know, the I don't know what he was talking about, but now I do. So he said, essentially, I had a style like, you know, the Jungle Book or the Aristocats, where they didn't finish the lines. They had this kind of...
Oh, those sketches, the sketchy prelims. Yeah, they were beautiful, actually, those Disney preliminary drawings.
Because they looked hand-drawn. I mean, where's the magic if everything looks like a photograph that's been painted over?
I mean, back then, they were all done by hand, weren't they? I mean, beautiful stuff, the old Disney
Absolutely. Stuff. So, I mean, I was hugely flattered. And the next thing you said was, you said, oh, yeah, you know what you should do? This is like, you know, the friend, he was being the friend giving advice, and I don't think he thought I'd take it seriously.
Right.
And he said, you know, you should do like a graphic novel.
He just came out with
you're an actress, so I'm sure you've written scripts. Of course I have. You know, you just put pictures and scripts together. And so I had no concept of how rigorous and difficult, and how many layers there are to creating a comic. And I just went, you know, the innocent abroad just went and bought every book on Amazon, because that was another excuse I could sort of, you know, top the stationery addiction with buying all of the DC books on penciling, inking, digital, this, that.
Those are good books, actually, the DC series inking and penciling. They were really good books. I got those myself, actually.
Yeah, I have my library, you can't see it because I've got my green screen up. On my library shelf are all those DC books. Also, I got a few amazing reprints of Andrew Loomis, who was a 1940s American illustrator, did a book. So his first book that I got was called Figure Drawing for All It's Worth, but absolutely fantastic rudiments of anatomy and perspective and all of those things that we have to learn. So the thing that I was missing and that I spent the most time training myself up in was the digital side.
Right.
You know, Yeah, so
you wanted to go into that. You weren't sort of just, oh, I'm going to do it by hand and then maybe learn the digital afterwards. You just wanted to learn everything there was to know as quickly as you could.
Because I had stories in my head, and I did a few hand-drawn, sort of biographical things called wishful inking, which was like, just like, you know, a day in the life of.
Yeah.
And I scanned them, and that's right, the first thing I bought was a scanner from Staples. And that was actually, I wrote it up at a comic adventure, my big thing of going to get an A3 scanner. But I'd done all this research, so I knew that I had to scan things. Mm. And I knew that you could clean up stuff and you know, darken it and add bubbles in Photoshop. So I knew I had to learn those things.
Mm.
So literally I spent 6 months where, thankfully, even though the old me would have thought, oh my God, nobody wants me, I'm finished. But, you know, there were no calls from the agent. I'd done spam a lot, and yet I was still, as it is with every actor, and it's worse now in lockdown, but you think you do a job that's really good, that you're just going to walk into the next thing, and it's not like that. You have to, it's like starting from square one every bloody time.
Yeah.
So, but to be honest, I couldn't care less. I was so busy. My kids and my husband didn't see me. That office door was shut. 11 o'clock every Wednesday night, I was doing an online course with a guy called Andy Fish. Hi, Andy. If it's going international, I remember you and I love you. And look at me now. So Andy Fish was doing an online course from Emerson College, Boston. And it was wonderful because, you know, I bought a book of his, really simple book called How to Do Graphic Novels.
Right.
And looking at it now, I mean, it's the most, because a lot of these books, as you know, Shane, they are for professionals anyway. They're very, very convoluted.
They tend to be quite advanced, yeah. I mean, you get the for beginners ones, which are just very basic, and then you get the really advanced stuff. And the stuff in between isn't so common.
No, and it would really... It would put somebody off. I think if you were somebody that had a yearning, and you could be a really talented, draw artist on paper, but it would just kind of do your head in, trying to get your head around all these, and you know, make sure the DPI is like this, and then get your margins in. And Jesus, it's just
very technical.
Mm. Yeah. So having done all that, the idea that I had in my head was what became my first fully blown graphic novel, Elsie Harris Picture Palace.
Right.
And we're talking about, so I'd say 2012 was the year that I kind of started seriously investigating and teaching myself how to make comics. And then 2013, I went to my very first convention, which was the London Super Comic Con.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had like 25 pages of what I think, I was very proud of it. It's like 25 pages of my Elsie book. And I was going around all these tables. First of all, I started gently. I was only going to go to artists in Artist Alley and talk about how they self-published and, you know, how they distributed their work.
Yeah.
And then I got emboldened because people were saying nice things about my work. And there was a stall for Titan Comics. And I chatted to this really friendly guy. I'm trying to remember his name. But he worked at Forbidden Planet in Cambridge. And he's so friendly. He said, your work's good. You know, you've got to show this. Steve White, who's the editor of Titan Comics, he's on the stall today. So it was kind of, oh my God, no time like the present. But no, I'm not there yet. This is too advanced. You could blow it. And then I mentioned my late mum. My late mum's partner, Bob, who you've met, Shane, because he's come to lots of the conventions.
Mm.
So Bob, many years ago, he trained as an architect and he loves drawing. And so when I started getting into this whole thing of, I want to make a comic, oh no, not just a comic, I want to do a graphic novel. He was so behind me and he's been like, my personal accountability partner. So I think everybody needs one of those. If you're doing anything, you know, you need someone who's going to say, how's it going, how many pages did you do this week, etc.
Yeah, it's not always possible to do that for yourself, is it? It is good if you've got someone like that. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's like the person that believes in you, who, so it's not all in your head. And you know, because we often start things and then we talk ourselves out because, oh no, you're being deluded. Everyone's going to laugh. Forget it. Leave it. But Bob said to me at that convention, I was not going to meet Steve White. I said to Bob, I said, oh, let's come back tomorrow because we've got, you know, we've got a 3-day ticket. I'll come back and have a, you know, get my portfolio. No. He's here. Just, you know, what can you lose? So
take the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did that. I'm Steve White, lovely man. And maybe he'll be listening.
Hey, Steve, if you're listening.
Yeah, hello, Steve, if you're listening. My very, very first true believer. Steve had a look at my pages and he looked and he didn't say anything. I was like, oh, shit, they're crap. They're really good. I wish I could take them back now. And then he said, yeah, he said, you know how to tell a story. They absolutely do. He said, you know, and you see your pages kind of improve as you go through. He said, no, keep in touch with me. And he gave me his card.
Right.
I was like, oh, wow. Oh, my God. The man at Titan Comics thinks I've got potential. So he did. He was true to his word. He kept in touch.
That's good.
And then at my next convention, and I'm going to kind of go through the story as quickly as I can.
That's all right. That's all right. You take your time.
Oh, my goodness me. I mean, we're at 45 minutes. Anyway, the next convention, I met the man who would become my mentor in comics, and that is the wonderful Mark Buckingham.
Mutual friend, very nice guy.
Yes, he's lovely and hugely talented. And, of course, by that time, I had kind of found the style of comics that I really liked and something I could relate to. So two of the comics were Madame Xanadu, and that was M.W. Kaluta, from, you know, the studio, and Matt Wagner.
Matt Wagner, Grendel.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff.
And Madame Xanadu, I'm praying that one of those comic houses revives it, because I want to draw for it. It's an amazing storyline. She's kind of like Doctor Who for women. I know we've got a female Doctor Who. But
yeah. It's a whole different thing. What you mean.
Yeah. And the other book that I picked up was Fables.
That Mark was working on.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so there was a Vertigo panel at the this was the London Film and Comic Con. See, I can remember.
Good memory.
And there was this panel for Vertigo. And again, Bob was with me and he said to me, look, Mark Buckingham's there, and there's a guy in a queue waiting to show him his portfolio. Why don't you show him your pages? And I really was nervous because I know Steve White's an editor. Jesus, if I knew what a brilliant artist he was at that time, I never would have showed him.
Yeah, Steve's a really good artist. Yeah.
He is off the scale for,
his dinosaur stuff. His dinosaurs are beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah. Really, really gorgeous. Yeah. So, I queued up and I met Mark, and he is just charm on a stick. He just smiled at me, opened my pages, and he just said, kept looking at them and said, oh, this is lovely. Yes, yes. And he said what Steve said. He said, you know how to tell a story.
That's the important thing, isn't it? I mean, whatever sort of inadequacies you may have in your illustrative or draftsmanship, the ability to tell a story, that's essential. That's the one thing you can't do without in comics.
Yes. And it was interesting because the guy who'd been before me in the queue for Mark, I mean, he had a massive A2 portfolio. He had a beret on. He looked like an artist.
A beret?
Yeah.
Wow.
And these, from what I could see peeking over my shoulder, I mean, they were these really intricate and really well-drawn drawings. And I said to Mark, I said, it's very kind of you, but you know, I mean, that guy, like, I can't be a contender. I can't draw. Like, he said to me, no, exactly what you said, Shane. He said, no. He said, your work will develop. He said, you're going to get better without a doubt. He said, but not everybody who is artistically talented can do comics. And he said, and that's what he said, we see person after person on these comic reviews, and it's really sad, but they'll do pinups, covers, but they don't know. And sometimes, I guess, they can draw things, and that's the most difficult thing as well. They can draw things that they've observed, but they can't make up something and make up a scenario and do it in a certain perspective, because, as we know, perspectives, or let's call them, for the sake of the layman, film angles.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking from the wheel of the car, or you're looking down off the building, and all of this stuff which makes the story dynamic is not what pretty pictures are made of.
No. Sometimes, you know, half the panels on your page might not be very pretty. They're functional, you know. I mean, it's, if you can make them all pretty, that's great. But sometimes it is just about, I need to get this mess, I need to communicate this part of the story effectively. And you sort of have to give up your sort of desire to make things look pretty you know, to sacrifice it in for the story.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing is, you have space in a comic and graphic novel. You know, you have got all these panels, so you don't have to draw everything in one panel. You just can do a little aspect, you know, and these were all things that I learnt on the job, so to speak. So anyway, fast forwarding, we get to, by the end of 2013, I'd made my first self-published comic, It Girl,
which was all about,
Clara Bow. Yeah. And I'd watched a documentary about her on BBC4. And I thought, this is the woman I want to do a bio comic of. So that came out before I got shortlisted for the Myriad Editions First Graphic Novel Award for Elsie Harris Picture Palace, which was amazing. So they, for that competition, you had to submit the first 30 pages.
Because you hadn't published it then, had you, at that time, I don't think?
No, hadn't published it. And I didn't go with Myriad because I got, and this is the beauty of having been an ex-Doctor Who person, I got a straightforward publishing offer from a publishing house called Milk. And Matt, where sadly Milk is no longer functioning, thank you, COVID. Yeah,
What a shame.
It is a shame. A wonderful, he had a shop, and he also published lots of beautiful produced books to do with Doctor Who mainly. Mm. But he also loves comics, and he sells comics in his shop. And he said, oh, I loved It Girl, and I really, really am interested in us publishing Elsie. And he said, I think it would appeal to our Doctor Who audience as well, being set in the 1930s. So it's the time element, if not the space element.
Mm.
So he published it, and then, you know, I was on a roll. It's like, yep, comics. This is where I'm at. This is what I want to do.
And that was a big book, wasn't it? How many pages was it?
152.
Yeah. That's a big project. And how long did it take you to actually draw those pages? You know, if you sort of miss out the time when you maybe stop drawing them for a while.
Yes. So I would say that, let's say, because I redrew those pages that I entered for the Myriad competition.
Are you reworking?
They kind of went, you know. No, actually, I tell a lie. I had to redraw. That's right. I redrew the first 30 pages. So my very early Elsie went in, you know, in the file for the archives, started redrawing. So I would say, okay, so I got the offer in, when was it, May? And she was going to be published. Is that May 2014?
Must have been,
and
around
she was
then.
Published the following. No, it was later. Anyway, she was published in 2015. But I just remember the artwork, because I spent a long time writing out the script. That's very important. I do a whole script. It's like a film script.
Oh, even though you're drawing it yourself, you fully script. You don't just plot it. Because I was going to ask about that, because you do everything yourself, pretty much, don't you, in your books?
Yeah.
And a lot of artists who do the things themselves, they'll just write a plot, and then they'll draw it, and then they'll script it, you know, it after they've drawn it. Almost like the old Marvel style, you know, because they're doing it themselves. So I think, you know, but so you actually do a full script.
Yep.
Wow.
Full script. And I don't go into Alan Moore detail on what's happening. I, you know, it's just a couple of lines of action.
No one goes into Alan Moore detail.
I credit the illustrator me with some intelligence as to how I'm going to, you know, set the shots out. So, but it is really useful because it's a time-saving thing. In the end, I'm not kind of thinking, oh, I could draw this, I could draw that. I literally know what I have to draw, and believe me, that's hard enough in itself, because for me, I mentioned that I was learning on the job, but you know, there were things like I had to make up an art director's art room And I was doing it from an overshot view. So I had to draw these draftsmen at their desks. I wanted like big windows. I wanted all sorts of different activity. It was so complex, but I'd written it and I thought, well, no, you can't shirk. You've written this story and you have to give the story everything it requires. So hell of a lot of research and pain. But you know what? Now that's done. It's like, I always think to myself, if I can jump forward. So my next project, before we run out of time, is I'm going my third graphic novel, because I did my graphic memoir, which was published a year ago. But this next work, which I'm really excited about, and I haven't, I'm about to dig into the full script. So Conrad Veit, does that name ring anything to you, Shane?
It doesn't, but I'm guessing it's a film star of yesteryear.
Yes. Now, do you know, here's a comic fact, and you should know this, or else you should.
Oh, you're going to show me up now.
Okay, so you know the Joker in Batman?
Yes, I do indeed.
And Bob Kane based that picture on a character, didn't he?
The original Joker?
Yeah.
It was a silent movie character, I think.
Yes.
And was he the actor?
He was.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he was an amazing man on many levels. So he's absolutely bloody gorgeous. I mean, he's kind of, if you put him in a modern setting, he just looked like a sort of goth punk. Big, beautiful, expressive eyes, you know, perfect for a silent movie. Yeah. But he was in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is, the very first horror film.
Yes, I'm totally aware now of exactly who you mean. I have watched that film. I watched it as a kid, actually. They used to rerun silent movies on BBC Two in the 80s a lot.
Yes.
And I remember watching this first horror movie as they dubbed it even then. And they talked about, you know, there weren't any effects then. It was all, you know, basic makeup and contortion of the face, you know.
Yes.
And his talent was just incredible, how he changed his face, you know.
Yes.
With minimal makeup.
Yeah, you mention it because he came through Max Reinhardt was the most famous German theatre director, and he went to Hollywood in the 30s. And they had a very stylized way of acting. I mean, the Germans, as you know, were just obsessed with all things gothic and dark. Mm. And they were coming out of the First World War, and that Cabinet of Dr. Caligari was really a tirade against the authoritarian government, who'd sent all the young men to a war they didn't want, as the Brits were. So Dr. Caligari was like a metaphor for a puppet doing the dirty work of the master, and Conrad Veit was playing the horrific character. Now, why I mention all this is because I was made aware when I started researching, because I was just fascinated. I'd seen him in Casablanca. He played the Nazi officer in that.
Yeah, got a bit typecast.
But you see, you'd never think of that Nazi officer as being somebody who'd made like 100 films in the German expressionist. He almost has these different careers. Mm. And the other film he did, which I love, is The Thief of Baghdad. He played the villain. So you can imagine I'm going to have amazing film stills to recreate.
It's a very rich story there, I would imagine.
Yeah. It's a very rich story. And without doing too many plot spoilers, he wasn't a German Jew, but he was married to a Viennese Jewish woman. And he always wrote on his documents when he was going in and out of Germany that he was Jewish. And he came, you know, he literally had a period of internment where he was being questioned by the Nazis. So that's going to be a very dramatic plot point in the story.
Yeah. And is this story going to be completely factual, or are you taking liberties at all?
How amazing you should ask that, because so the premise is I have a young actor, modern day actor. And at the beginning of the story, we see that he's been, before lockdown, he's been doing a production of Romeo and Juliet, but it's been set in the time in Berlin just before the war. And it's like, you know, the instead of the houses of of the Montagues and Capulets. It's a Jewish family and a high ranking Nazi officer.
Oh, right.
So that's the premise. So I've got this actor and he's on the brink of success. You know, he's sort of like going to be the next Rob Pattinson. Suddenly lockdown happens and he's been offered a part in a film. He's been had this meeting with American filmmakers to do a film about these German emigres in Hollywood. So he would play Conrad Veidt and there'd be, you know, a Fritz Lang and a Peter Lorre in the film.
Right, okay.
And then of course lockdown happens, and I won't tell you anymore, but the guy, the actor who's called Joel, becomes obsessed with Conrad Veidt. You know, he doesn't know anything about this actor, but he kind of feels that Conrad, there's like a, he has a relationship with Conrad. Kinship. There are parallels, you know, he's like talking to him through generations.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. So that's a really interesting way of telling a story about a character through another character's eyes almost. It's a really different take on it, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, your previous book was a very straight, this is the story of this actress. So you almost feel that you have to take another tack, don't you, to keep it fresh. And I like that. That's a really good way of doing it. Yeah.
Well, it also helps me because Conrad Veidt was a very enigmatic man. There are loads of, you know, pieces from magazines, etc. But he actually said, why should I write a biography? I'm just an actor. No one, you know, I don't do anything special. So I think he was one of the most special men that ever was. So that's why I have to write this book, but I have to do it filtered through, because if I just do a kind of stretched out and then he did this and then he did that, you know, no one cares. And I may not even get the facts right. You know, he could have had a whole secret life that we don't know about, but it's not for me to conjecture. All I can do is, I think you can read, I feel this as an actress myself, but there are certain, when you watch people's interpretations on the screen, there's a whole world of backstory that has gone on to bring them to that moment. So I think when you talk about Caligari and how amazing Conrad Veidt was in that film, and from what I know of the research that I've done, he did go, he was drafted in the First World War and he wasn't a natural soldier, you know.
No.
He didn't want to go to war and he contracted typhoid. And I think it must have been a terrible, terrifying brush with death and seeing his friends all, you know, shot at.
Yeah, I mean, everyone who went into that war, if they survived, they saw a horrendous amount of death, didn't they?
Yeah.
We can't even imagine in our time, you know, in our lives, you know, what that must have been like. Horrendous, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that is in itself is rich with stories, isn't it?
Yes.
That period of history, you know. I'm really fascinated. You've got me.
Hooray! Oh, good. So the other thing I can mention then, Shane, is, you know, so with my last book, Life Drawing, it was published by Unbound, and we had a crowdfunding campaign for it, and I was extremely lucky. We had to raise a lot of money for that book, and I got all the funding in. Now, this next book is with a new publisher. So Lizzie Kay, who you know, who used to be at Unbound and Titan, she has her own publishing house called Cast Iron Books. Yeah.
Cast Iron?
Yes.
Okay.
And she's got a book called Future. That's the first publication coming out in a few months. And it's a boutique publishing house. And she has signed me up to do Conrad. And she's expecting it in 2021.
Ooh, so I've got to crack on. Pressure's on. But you're sort of into the script now.
I'm into the script. Yeah. But it's going to be, I mean, we're going to be on Kickstarter probably when the book is entirely finished. So not like my last book, which was like, please, please, can I have some money? And I hadn't even kind of started the book. So I'm duty bound to produce something that people will want. But I do know that the people at Kickstarter are excited about the idea of a Conrad Veidt book, as you are too. So
I'm very excited by it.
Yeah.
So what we'll do, Jess, is when you are ready to launch that Kickstarter, we'll get you onto the live show and we'll do a promotion of it.
Yay! Oh my God, that would be amazing.
Yeah, we'll get you onto the live video show and we can hopefully show some pages from it. That would be really cool. Yeah.
That would be amazing. So I'll quickly touch on something else that I haven't signed the contract, so I'm hoping that it all comes to pass. But
you're not going to get into trouble now, are you, talking about any of this?
No, I'm not, because actually they want me to talk about it in a way I don't want to talk about it until like the dry. You know how it is.
Yeah.
And things are so busy at the moment. I don't know how I'm going to have the hours to do all the things.
Well, you've been doing a lot of acting lately as well, haven't you? And you've written you've written a musical, is that right?
I've written a play.
Play? Wow.
A serious play, Shane. So, and in fact, the subject of this play would also be a great graphic novel, but I don't even want to think about that. So the play is called Hallie's Comet, and it's about a woman called Hallie Flanagan. Now, in the 30s, as we all know, America suffered the Great Depression.
Yeah.
You know, worse than lockdown. and I know ours is just, we can't go out shopping and have an ice meal. I mean, that was, you know, people drinking soup made out of water and stones.
Yeah.
Living in boxes.
Again, we cannot imagine, can we?
No, we can't imagine.
No.
And President Roosevelt set up, and the reason why the play is relevant now, because I actually started writing it about 10 years ago, but it's highly relevant because President Roosevelt, instead of just throwing money, you know, funding, he wanted people to get back to work and have the dignity of working.
Mm.
So with people in the theatre industry, and that's why this is close to my heart, people in the theatre industry, he wanted to make work for them, and he asked a woman. This is my heroine, Hallie Flanagan. She was completely unknown to the public. She was working as a drama professor in an elite girls' school, so they could afford to put on good productions.
Mm.
And they were so hard-hitting. They were, like, socially relevant. They were called living newspapers.
Oh.
And she ended up having, Broadway notables would come to the school and see her stuff.
Wow.
So when Roosevelt decided that he wanted to do something, have a project, so the Workers Progress Alliance, that's right, the WPA was what was going to be set up to help all these people out of work. And he called on Hallie Flanagan to set up a project called the Federal Theatre Project. And my play charts the story of the incredible things this woman and wonderful creative people Orson Welles as a 20-year-old directed a mixed race production of, I'm not going to say it, but the Scottish play, directed that, was called Voodoo .. And it was shown in Harlem. It was absolutely,
I know about that. There was a graphic novel about that. Yeah.
Wow. Well,
I've still got copies. I'll have to send you one because I distributed it. So I've got like 10 copies. So I'll have to send you one. It was a really interesting graphic novel about it. It was a friend of mine who did it. Yeah, I'll have to send you that.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. So, I mean, the whole thing, you sort of think about everybody nowadays, you know, I'm getting opportunities because I'm a woman. Not in spite of being a woman. It's like, please, come on, we need more women. I'll give you anything. You're a woman. Hooray. You know, and it's all this kind of, I'm saying it, ironically. I mean, I think it's wonderful, you know, diversity and inclusivity. But I have to say it by the same token that people were breaking barriers and cutting through glass ceilings many years ago. Mm. But unfortunately, and that's the kind of the downside of my Hallie Flanagan's story, is she ended up getting interrogated by the House Un-Americans Activity Committee for, because they said that everything she was doing was communist. Of course it was.
Oh, gosh.
Because you're helping people. You want to give stuff to people. You want to help the underdog. What are you thinking? And, you know, we're not a
lot of artists, and writers were accused of communism, weren't they, because of their sort of more socialist beliefs, if you like, and they were just labelled as communists because they, you know, they just thought a little bit differently, or they were a little bit bohemian, you know.
Yeah, absolutely bohemian. So you know, they probably mixed with people of different ethnic backgrounds. They probably had gay friends and all of those things. You just think, well, isn't that part of being a, you know, humanitarian, just a normal, kind-hearted, liberal person. But of course,
It was frowned upon. It was frowned upon in that era, wasn't it? So any sort of liberal ideas and especially socialist ideas, you know, and they still are in America, you know, they're scared of that word, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely scared, because it's a threat to this idea of, which is totally ridiculous, you know, this idea of self-reliance. And we talk about, you know, in the comics, we talk about self-published and being independent, but truth be told, we, all of us, we may do the work, a lot of the work by ourselves, but in the end, you know, you've got to find an amazing comics printer, you've got to find an audience for your book, you've got to find a convention that's going to take you on, and you know, all those things. So everybody is interdependent.
Of course.
And you know, when you pay it forward and when you help people, it just kind of seems to grease the wheels, but there's some kind of universal law that helps, you know, you get on. Mm-hmm. And
I do believe that. I think, you know, if the more you help others, the you serve yourself. I do think that. I do believe that. And I always find that, you know, because it's not, you know, sometimes it's human nature, isn't it, to be selfish? But when you overcome that and you find yourself being more giving and more caring and more helpful, you do find that other people are more willing to help you, and it all comes back. Not always, you know, it's not a fair world.
No.
But I do think there's a lot to be said for that. I really do.
And
I hope I'm right.
You are right. And it's lovely that it's you saying it, because that's the thing that I found when I entered the comics world, as opposed to now, I don't want to disrespect my fellow peers in the entertainment industry, because they are loving and giving, but it is a more cutthroat place to be, because there are far more people in it, you know, and that's just the law of maths. Not everybody can have a job at any given time. There's just not enough to go around. And so people are going to be more self-serving. It's the natural instinct, and protective of their connections, whatever. But no, I mean, I think I was astounded that someone, so I've mentioned Mark Buckingham, for instance, but you know, so many, he and everybody that I've met, and it doesn't matter from, you know, where they are in the comics world, they love you because you're doing what they love. It's kind of, we're in this together.
Yeah, you know? It's very much like that comic industry. You know, I would say, you know, 90% of people in comics are like that. You know, they're just glad there's another person who's seen how great the medium is. Yeah. I think that's the thing, because we were, for so long, you know, comic creators and comics fans felt isolated, you know. And that as time's progressed and more, when they see somebody getting into comics who's maybe not a traditional comics fan, like yourself, you know, or somebody from a different background who's getting into comics who might not have previously been into comics, it's great, because you just think, oh, there's more people who understand. Yeah, there's more people who want to create and want to read, and we can talk to them about the things that we love. And I think that's why it's such an inclusive industry, because we just want more people to get it, you know, to be in the club. And it's great.
Absolutely. Because it's always struck, I mean, that's where it is the same as the acting industry. I sort of think, oh God, we're still at that thing of, oh, got to raise some money. We need to get, you know, maybe another comic shop's closed, or another publishing house hasn't made it, you know, and we just, it's that thing of trying to keep, you know, stoking the fire and keeping it going.
Yeah.
But what I will say is, and I'm so thrilled that I shared with you, because I haven't spoken about Conrad for so long.
Oh, because, really?
Well,
I feel honoured.
Well, you know, I've had to kind of put it on a back burner. It's on my list. It's like December, you sit and you write your script. Because,
that's it. You know, that's your instructions for the month. Yeah, sit and write.
Right. Absolutely. And we're talking about that. But I've got people that aren't in the comics industry who are interested in that. So
Brilliant.
There you go.
Brilliant. You know, and that's what I love about comics like that, that do something a little bit different. They also bring in new people into comics, because I do believe that the way that comics will survive and the way that comics will expand is by expanding the genres, so that it's not all, you know, one or two genres that currently dominate comics. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love superheroes and I love crime comics, I love horror comics, you know, I love those genres. But they do tend, well, not, yeah, most, it's, let's face it, it's 90% superheroes, isn't it? And that's, I think that's a barrier, you know, because not everybody's into that genre. And it's when you get different genres like this, it's bringing in new people. I've got a friend who publishes, you know, war history comics, and he sells them at you know, military fairs. And so you've got all these different people. They've probably never read comics before, maybe when they were kids, you know, so they understand how to read a comic. But they probably haven't read a comic for 30, 40 years. But suddenly, because it's a genre that they have an interest in, I don't know if you know the things that Hannah Berry was doing, where everyone was getting together on Zoom and we were
talking. Oh, yeah, the comics research thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was in on a couple of those, and I think it was Phoenix who said that... I got his name the wrong way around then. Sorry, Woodrow. Sorry, Woodrow. Woodrow Phoenix. Get it the right way around, Shane. He's not a Bajoran. That's a very odd Star Trek reference. So, yeah, and I think what Woodrow said was that, you know, if we go into different genres, you know, wholeheartedly and genuinely, we will bring in these new audiences and these new... And I totally agree with him on that. And I think that the work that you're doing and other people working in different genres like this, I think it's just great. You know, I really do. I think it's a great way of expanding the medium and the art form into much bigger readerships. So more power to you, Jessica.
Hey, thank you. And do you know what? The other thing that I feel, here I am bigging myself up, but it's interesting because when I met Mark Buckingham and Steve White, so Mark is obviously an established and very famous DC Comics artist amongst other people that he works for. Mm. And Steve was an editor and he's gone back into doing his art. Yeah. And he did say to me that I inspired him. I showed him that it's never too late.
Oh,
to
really?
Follow your bliss. Yep.
Isn't that nice?
Yep.
And
Mark Buckingham is making music and are sort of writing songs. Mm. And he said to me, you know, I've seen the value of, I want to do this and I'm going to do it.
So, oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
It's great, isn't it? It's great if you can do that, even if it's one or two people, if you can just give them encouragement to, to do this, the podcast, I was inspired by a friend of mine who does a podcast and I helped him out doing some podcasting with him. You know, I'd never thought about doing one much before, apart from, I think when I saw the guys from Geek Syndicate, you know, Barry and Dave, you know.
Yeah.
They inspired me they give me the desire to want to do one, and then I sort of put it on the back a bit, like what you were saying, you know, it's like, well, there's a bit of work to do there, I need to buy this equipment and I need to learn about this,
right,
sat on it for a while, and then one day it just clicked. It's like, no, wait a minute, if I want to do this, just do. And you learn as you go. And I'm still learning. I'm still learning how to do it and how to get better. But you've got to start somewhere, haven't you? And then you look back years later. I mean, you must look back now. We will stop in a second because I've kept you much longer than I should have done. But you must look back now at that time when you started and think, I am so glad that I took that step because look at what I've achieved.
Yes. Mm. Yes, I think I took a photograph of all my comics and graphic novels to date. I'm just going to flick through because I was astounded, you know. So let's say I kicked off in properly 2013. So that's like 7 years ago. Mm. And so proud. So this is going to be my subliminal advertising, Shane, because I mentioned all the things I've done. So Shane can see this and no one else can.
Well, actually, I can't because your background's covering.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've got one. Okay, here are the titles from 2013 to now, including things I've collaborated on. So, It Girl, and then Vivacity. That was a comic I did about Vivian Leigh.
Oh, how could I forget that? Yeah.
Oh, well, it's easy to. The years have flown, haven't they? But that did very well. Still does well, although Gone with the Wind has been taken off the telly for all those reasons. Two Arms. So Two Arms was a little kind of small anthology of World War One stories that I contributed to. And the major one that I contributed to was To End All Wars.
Oh, yes.
That got nominated for two Eisners.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, and that had everybody in it. So then we've got Elsie Harris' Picture Palace. There are still a few. There are a few copies left. Which
oh, really?
Oh. Yeah, there's only 40 copies left in the world.
Wow.
I think you never know. One day we might do a reboot, but in a smaller, you know, softback edition.
Yeah.
The Inking Woman, so that was a collection of, you know, all the women that done comics from the 19th yeah. century to now that Myriad published. I've got the, I've got my Vertigo thing that I did with Mark Buckingham. I finished off his stories for SFX, and I've got my Doctor Who that I did for Titan. I've illustrated myself in a story.
I remember that, yeah, because I remember we had a little bit of a giggle. It's like, I was in Doctor Who and now I'm drawing Doctor Who.
And actually that very elegantly leads me to, so the other thing that I can sort of talk about a bit, so there was a journalist, Chris McCauley, who is now writing comics, and he absolutely loved my work. I mean, he loves Doctor Who anyway, but he loved the work that I did for the Titan comics. And he has invited me to illustrate a line of, now, I say Bram Stoker, who obviously wrote Dracula. They're not just Dracula stories, but he is working with the descendant, the great-great-great-great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, Decker Stoker.
Yeah,
runs the estate. They are getting together a collection of stories and histories relating to Bram Stoker, and I'm going to be there. Main illustrator.
Wow, that sounds really cool.
And that's with a publisher who normally do. Now, Shane, I don't know whether you yourself do gaming and stuff like that.
I'm not
that,
a big gamer, no.
Okay, well, some of the folks out there, I'm sure, are.
A lot of the people listening will be, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so they may be aware of, there's a publishing company called Andrews, Andrews UK, and they do audiobooks, they do nostalgia, retro gaming magazines and games.
Ah, right, the retro gaming, yeah.
Yeah, and they are moving into comics. So, you know, look out Titan. They are going to be like a major comics distributor and publishing
and publisher.
House.
So, I'd love to speak to them and see, you know, I'd love to find out more about what they're planning. That'd be really cool.
They have got lots of big plans. So I am awaiting the contract from them. And yes, I'm going to be, I mean, it's a big thing. There are going to be regular comics, audio books, and who knows what. So
That's exciting. I always love to hear about new publishers because you think there's a potential there, you know, what are they going to do? What sort of books are they going to put out? I love to hear that. Fantastic. Well, that sounds amazing, Jess. That's really... So it looks like you're going to be on the scene again once the conventions start up again next year.
Very much so, because I do miss the conventions. As I say, I get to have the personal connection with the fans, and also, you know, I love having a shop. I never dreamt of myself as being the proprietor of an emporium of comics, but it's a rather lovely thing, setting up your stall. And
You always have a very impressive stall. I always notice when you come to ICE, you know, and you set up, you have really nice banners, and the way that your table is set out is all, there's always a lot of consideration. You know, some people just come along and just plonk their books, you know, and go, there you go, buy a book.
Yeah.
But there's always a lot more than that at your stalls, and it's nice to see. I wish everyone went to such a...
Well, I mean, I can, you know, I can guide people if they, because it's, I can understand it. I think a lot of the people that go to the conventions and sell stuff, they're more interested in making the things than actually selling it.
Yeah, I think most artists are just artists. It's hard. It's very hard for a lot of creative people, I think, to be everything else that they need to be, to sell their work. And it's a shame, and sometimes they need help and sometimes they don't want help.
Which is
fair enough.
I just want a stall and I want to put my head down and do some drawing.
Don't bother me. Don't bother me unless you want to buy something.
Yeah, exactly. And no, I can't sell you anything because I don't have any change in my flow.
Oh, that's a classic. Although I must admit, I have done that before, forgotten to get a float, you know, for a table when I was doing publishing a lot. And it's all these little things you have to remember, isn't it, at a convention, you know? You really do have to have a little bit of a business mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, a business mind. And I suppose that's where my old showbiz background comes in handy, because you're putting on a show and you've got to, you know, there's a lot to be said for selling Yeah. A lot of people who bought my things, they never came to the convention thinking, oh, I'm going to buy Jessica Martin's comic. We had a conversation and then they were intrigued and so on and so forth. So,
Well, you're selling yourself as well as your work, aren't you? And I suppose that's the similarity with, you know, with the acting career, you know, because as an actor, you have to sell you. You know, it's not just your, because how do you get your ability across? It's not always easy to do that. So it's about selling who you are and what, not just what you can do. And I think because you've got that skill, obviously from years of being an actor, you can now apply it very well to your art career as well.
One hopes. And one hopes that those doors will open again in the theatre of comics.
Let's hope so. Well, we've gone well over our hour, but it's been an absolute pleasure, I have to say. It's been really nice to catch up.
I know, it's been lovely to catch up, Shane.
Yeah.
And I was so thrilled when your message came through, because I had seen you saying, oh, we're doing our ice cream. I'm thinking, oh.
Yeah. Where's mine?
I've been feeling so out of the loop, do you know what I mean? Well, kind of because I haven't been making comics as well, because in the lockdown, it's a weird thing. As you say, I wrote the play, so that was a chunk of time, you know, and I had to pitch Conrad, so that was probably, you know, June that all happened. Now, fingers crossed. I mean, the Dracula thing I'm kind of nervous about, because I'm thinking, oh shit, they want me to do this, but I'm going to have to do a lot of time management, but obviously I can't look a gift horse in the mouth because these opportunities don't come up.
And again,
I won't worry, because if push came to shove, if I couldn't fulfill something, I can think of five artists who I would recommend. But again, it's like thinking, oh God, I don't want to lose my gig. But you know what? I've proven, I've got nothing left to prove. I don't have to do every bloody thing that's there.
Yeah,
you know?
But I suppose if you've got a passion for it and you want to do it, you don't want to give it up, do you? That's the thing. If you feel that's for you and it's a job that you really sort of have an affinity with, it's hard to say no, isn't it? Because it's not just about doing the job or getting the job. It's you actually want to do it, and that's a nice thing. It's not always, you know, we don't always have that opportunity in life to work on things that we actually love. So it's hard to relinquish it when you get the opportunity. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you again at, you know, at a con and having a proper catch up and all that sort of stuff.
When are you hoping to do the next ice con? Do you think?
Well, I'm hoping that we're hoping to do the festival, you know, the Shrewsbury Festival in June.
Right.
And we're hoping that the next ice will probably be the usual time, September next year, which we're hoping by then things should be back to normal.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
We've got the vaccines. And Shrewsbury is going to be outside, so that will be fine.
That's what we're hoping, because even though things might not be quite back to normal, because most of it's outdoors, fingers crossed, we'll still be able to do it. Yeah.
Great. So I better get my skates on. So if Conrad, Lizzie expects it by next October. So
We could do something maybe. Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah. Thanks ever so much again, Jess, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Bye-bye.
Bye.